47 years ago, the eyes of the world focused on two people. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took a walk, which would be no big deal in most circumstances, but the walk was on the surface of the moon, the first visit by humans there. There were a few more over the next 3.5 years, then we said goodbye to the moon. Today's guest takes an issue with that. Paul Spuditz writes of the advantages of our natural satellite in The Value of the Moon, how to explore, live, and prosper in space using the moon's resources. Paul Spuditz is a geologist who was, in a sense, captured by the moon's gravity long ago. He studies the history and processes of the moon and was involved in planning and guiding the science investigation work of a couple of robotic moon missions. Paul is the author of more than 100 papers and 6 books and won the Space Pioneer Award of the National Space Society for 2011. Dr. Spuditz, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello, Jeff. How are you?
Good. Good to have you here. 20 years ago, one of the other books was The Once and Future Moon. At that time, did you think by then we'd be back by now?
I certainly hope so. And, our the hopes and aspirations of the moon community have sort of risen and fallen with the years. Sometimes we're riding high, and other times we're laid low. At the moment, there's no direct effort to go to the moon by this country, but there are efforts by some of the internationals to do so.
So why, in your opinion, did we send people to the moon if not to go further in space?
Well, you need to look at Apollo as sort of a historical aberration in a sense. It was not really about space or about the moon at all. It was really a battle in a geopolitical struggle here on the Earth. The goal that Kennedy articulated, and by the way, that was 55 years ago as of yesterday, it was to the date, on May 25th in 61, was to go to the moon and do it in a decade. And the unstated assumption of that challenge was to beat the Russians to the moon, beat the Soviet Union. And that was very much in the minds of the Congress and the minds of the American public at that time, was that we were behind in the race to space, and we needed to beat the Russians to the moon to show that we were the most technologically advanced and had the superior economic and political system. So in that sense, the Apollo program was all about beating the Soviet Union. It wasn't really about establishing a long-term capability in space to access it and use it.
All right. So when we think about traveling to the moon, either by people or by robotic craft, what's the difference in cost there? I can imagine it must be tremendously more to send people and bring them back.
Well, it of course it's more expensive because largely you have to bring all the consumables, life support, air and water and food with you with people, and that requires a lot of mass and a lot of power to operate. But in actual fact, one of the things I'm advocating, and the reason I call my book The Value of the Moon, is that a lot of those consumables, including the water we drink, the food we eat, the propellant that we need to burn in rockets, can be acquired from the moon. So therefore, the moon is not simply a destination. It's a place that allows us to create new spacefaring capabilities.
Okay, so let's take those in turn. You mentioned water, and that's the easiest of the three, certainly, because as you point out in the book, there's evidence that there is water ice on the poles of the moon. How clear is that evidence?
Well, it's very clear at the moment that water exists, and we know that it exists in fairly significant quantities from a variety of data sets and measurements done from orbit and on the ground. One of the details, this was one of the big discoveries of the last 10 years. We've had a fleet of international robotic missions to the moon, orbiters and crash landers, and they have found that the moon not only has water, but it has it in fairly significant quantities. So water is one of the most useful things you can have in space. It can not only support human life by both drinking it and using it to reconstitute your food and for sanitation, you can also crack that water into its component gases, hydrogen and oxygen. You can breathe the oxygen. You can combine hydrogen and oxygen gas in a fuel cell to generate electricity. And then when you have sunlight, you can crack the water back into the component gases. So it's a medium of energy storage. It also helps protect humans from radiation. Water is the best radiation shielding we know of. So you could jacket your habitat with water and protect yourself from the cosmic rays of deep space. And finally, and most importantly, those gases, hydrogen and oxygen, can be cryogenically frozen into liquid form, and that makes the most powerful chemical rocket propellant we know of. So water is useful. It has value in both supporting human life and in enabling additional spaceflight to further destinations. That's why I think it's likely to be the first resource that we try to access and use.
All right, so that takes care of the water and propellant parts. You mentioned reconstituting food. Is there some advantage to having water on the moon that would allow us to make food?
Well, absolutely. I mean, ultimately, if you want to have extended presence on the moon for a variety of reasons, you're going to have to be able to produce some of what you need locally instead of importing everything from the Earth. So one example would be to grow plants in lunar soil. Plant growth would require both water, but also things like nitrogen and phosphorus, elements that act as fertilizer in terrestrial soils. All of those elements are present on the moon in varying quantities. And so the stuff that we access at the poles and harvest can also help us enable long-term human habitation on the moon as well.
Would the habitation be to its own end, or would it be to act as something like a launch pad to exploration further out in the solar system?
It would be both. I mean, one of the things that you want to use the moon for, for which you want to use the moon, is to learn how to live and work productively on another world. So ultimately, one of the goals of the space program is to expand human reach further and further into space. And to do that, you have to learn a lot of different skills. You have to learn how to cope with the harsh environment. You have to learn how to protect people from the various processes that can destroy living tissue. So that needs to be understood. You need to understand how to work in a fractional gravity. The moon has 1/6 the gravity of the Earth. And you need to understand how to best explore a planet. What's the optimum mix of people and robots, and which jobs are appropriate for each one. All those things can be learned by living on the moon.
We will talk more with Paul Spoutis when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a bit. We'll talk about The Value of the Moon, his book. It's subtitled How to Explore, Live, and Prosper in Space Using the Moon's Resources. We'll come back and talk more with Paul and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the lunar scientist and geologist Paul Spoutis, who's written a book, one of his six books now, about the value of the moon is the title of the book, How to Explore, Live, and Prosper in Space Using the Moon's Resources. He takes issue with the fact that we left the moon in 1972, at least with human feet, and haven't been back since, and it has many uses to us. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you've got some observations about space program efforts in the past or things you'd like to see in the future. We'll hear those. 800-838-3760 if you join us by phone. You can join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So when you talk about where the space program is now versus where it has been in the past, your sentence here is interesting. You say strategic confusion abounds in the American civil space program. What are we confused about, Paul?
Well, we're sort of confused on exactly what our goals are. There seems to be the idea that we're on a trip to Mars. The voyage to Mars is the way NASA puts it. But in actual fact, we don't have the capability, either technically or fiscally, to engage in a human Mars mission right now. Fundamentally, it requires on the order of £1 million in orbit to send a mission to Mars, a human mission to Mars. And at the end of that, all you have is a small return vehicle. You discard all those pieces along the way. Now, that's a Mars mission done in the same way that Apollo is done. Apollo had a Saturn V liftoff. It weighed 6.5 million pounds, and basically the small command module was the only thing that came back. And that was unsustainable. We went to the moon. The first landing was in 1969, and as you noted, we stopped going there in 1972. So you simply couldn't sustain that rate of cost for the return that you got. So the problem with the confusion is that because they're still thinking in this Apollo mode, we're not thinking about permanence. We're not thinking about space-based infrastructure. And most importantly, we're not thinking about using what the moon has to offer in terms of energy and material resources to enable those kinds of long-duration missions.
The kinds of ways in which the Americans assemble our vehicles, though, I mean, I remember seeing years ago that the Soviets certainly did it cheaper with basically kerosene-based fuel instead of the high-tech stuff we've used. Would there be advantages to going with the so-called big dumb booster?
There's a certain advantage of scale in that the bigger rocket you have that's able to launch a bigger, more massive payload, the lower the cost per kilogram is to get to space. But that's only one trade parameter. I mean, there's a lot of things you need to consider. You need to consider effectively how you stage at various points in a mission. Mars is 50 million miles away, and so we have to make our vehicles autonomous. You can't control things from that kind of distance. So you need to adapt a different mindset as you go deeper and deeper into space. It's not simply a matter of lifting everything you need off the Earth. You also want to be able to start using what you find in space to create these capabilities.
And so if you don't have to lift off the Earth, if you can find stuff on the moon, for example, you're having to deal with a lot less power to get off of the surface of that structure.
Exactly. Because the moon has only one-sixth the gravity of the Earth, it's much easier to launch mass off the moon than it is off the Earth. And off the Earth, we're talking thousands of dollars per kilogram into space. On the moon, that would be much less, on the order of a few tens of dollars per kilogram.
Paul Spoutis, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Value of the Moon. I want to dial things way back in time. Paul, are there still competing theories about the moon's origin?
Yes and no. There's general agreement on how it came about, but there's less agreement on the details of it. The general agreement is that 4.5 billion years ago, there were actually two objects orbiting at about the Earth's distance from the Sun. And these two objects collided, and is what's called the giant impact. And that collision spun off a disk of gas and debris that later coalesced to form the Moon. So that's what's generally agreed upon, that model of formation. But as you might expect, that raises a whole bunch of other questions that we don't know the answer to. Exactly what were the conditions of the impact, how much of the material comes from the proto-Earth as opposed to the impactor, what processes worked to condense the various elements in their various their different abundances in the two bodies. All those details are what lunar scientists are actively working on now.
There's an interesting symbiosis you bring up in here and indicate that aside from light and tides, that the moon actually provides some stability for the Earth.
Yes, that's right. Because we have such a massive moon, and the Earth-Moon system has the largest ratio of mass to satellite to primary in the solar system, it's actually considered as a double planet. And because of that massive, the large mass of the moon in relation to its primary, it's helped stabilize the Earth's axial precession. So, in fact, we don't get the wild swings in obliquity that, for example, a planet like Mars has had in the past, which keeps us with a nice, fairly equitable climate, which enables life to thrive.
So evolution, as we know it, is partly responsible, or the moon's partly responsible for that.
That's correct. And in addition to the axis stability, it also, the tides offer an opportunity to let marine creatures thrive under subaerial conditions once a month or twice a month. So in other words, that allows them to basically allowed life to emerge from the seas onto the land because you get this tidal variation.
Well, I hadn't thought about that. The creatures crawling on land because the land was a lot more accessible to them.
Exactly. And so that zone, that tidal zone where you sort of span the difference between the marine environment and the terrestrial environment was very important, and the moon is responsible for that.
So in addition to the history of the moon, you get into the history of our understanding of the moon here on Earth. As telescopes got better, did many scientists end up just looking past the moon, almost like like ignoring your kid brother or something?
Well, the problem was is that as astronomy developed, they became interested in more and more deep sky objects. And in that sense, the moon kind of acts as a deterrent, because during full moon, it's so bright that you can't see these very faint objects. So astronomers looked at the moon, they cataloged its surface features, and then they decided to look beyond the moon, and the moon actually became a nuisance to them, not necessarily an object worthy of study. But the geologists picked up on that. Geology deals with the history and evolution of the solid rocky planets, And, of course, the moon is one of those. It's a solid object. It's made of rock. It's made of the same minerals that we find on the Earth. And so as geologists began to take over studies of the moon, they kind of got interested in the question of what's the origin of its landforms, what's the crust made of, was there volcanism in the past? All those questions were asked and posed before the Apollo missions, and of course after the Apollo missions we learned the answers to many of them, that the craters are impact, that there were lavas that were erupted on the moon for over a billion years, and that craters still form to this day on the surface of the moon, although at a much lower rate than in the past.
So among the things that make the moon interesting to casual observers, why are there so many craters?
Most of the craters that you see on the moon were formed very early in its history. The interesting thing about the moon is it preserves the record of its early evolution that has been erased on the Earth. So the moon formed about 4.5 billion years ago. Its solid crust dates from about 4.3 billion years. The craters that you see on the moon today were formed between that time and about 3.8 billion years ago, within a 600 million year time frame. And that record, that geological record, perfectly complements the part of the geological record that's missing from the Earth. On the Earth, those craters have been erased by crustal recycling caused by plate tectonics, by erosion, by the hydrosphere, the oceans and the rivers that erode the terrain. All those things have erased that record from the Earth, and yet we can recover that record from the features on the moon. So in that sense, the moon is sort of a key to understanding the early history of the Earth and the other terrestrial planets.
Ah, so where there's no weather, there's no weathering. The moon just keeps a record all through time. Did it get hit more than the Earth, or does it just preserve the record better?
No, it actually gets hit less than the Earth because its gravity well is shallower. However, because it preserves this record back to nearly the very beginning of the solar system, it has much more craters than the Earth simply because it's preserving that ancient population.
Paul Spoutis is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, geologist, lunar scientist, and author. His latest book is called The Value of the Moon, How to Explore, Live, and Prosper in Space Using the Moon's Resources. We're getting a fascinating tour of the moon with many more details to come. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions for Paul or maybe some observations about the moon and our treatment of it over the years. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We do know plenty about the lit side of the moon, the one that faces us. The Clementine mission, which you were part of, Paul, mapped the whole moon. Were there some surprises from that?
Yes, there were. There were actually quite a few surprises. Clementine went to the moon in 1994, and it orbited the moon for about 3 months. And during that time, it mapped the color of the moon in 11 colors in the infrared and the visible. But in addition, we also mapped the shape of the moon. For the first time, we made a global topographic map of the moon. And the big surprise from that mission, there were many surprises, but the two biggest discoveries. One was the fact that there is an enormous impact crater, a basin, that's actually that's about two-thirds of the size of the continental United States on the far side of the moon. It's called the South Pole Aiken Basin. It's one of the biggest impact features known in the solar system. And it covers the entire southern hemisphere of the far side of the moon. It's 13 kilometers deep. That's about three times the depth of the Grand Canyon, and it's 2,600 kilometers across. It's an enormous crater that formed very early in lunar history, and it was a big surprise to a lot of us how big and how deep it was, how well preserved it was. And then, of course, the other thing that we discovered was the interesting nature of the poles. We found first that there are areas near the poles with peaks that get nearly permanent sunlight. These peaks stick up in the sun because the moon's obliquity is only a degree and a half. So that means that the sun is always near the horizon at the pole. And if you're on a peak, you may always be in the sun, and if you're in a deep hole, you may never see the sun. So those two things combine to make the poles interesting because in these dark areas, it's extremely cold. And any water molecule that gets trapped there is effectively stuck there forever. So over time, even though the addition rates are very slow, you can accumulate significant amounts of water in those dark areas, and the peaks that are nearby are in permanent sunlight, so you can use those to generate electrical power. So it's sort of the ideal location on the moon. It's sort of like an oasis on the lunar desert.
So if there is water ice there, and you mentioned there's lots of evidence that suggests there is, any idea how accessible that would be?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't really know because we haven't actually been to the surface to explore it in detail. What we've done is we've mapped the terrain around both poles, and we know the extent of the dark area. We have sensors that enable us to detect the presence of hydrogen and the presence of ice, and that's how we know that it's there. But it doesn't give us a precise enough estimate of the quantities there. Our current estimate is that at each pole there is at least several hundred million tons of water ice, but we don't know exactly where the highest concentrations are, which is one of the things you'd want to know if you wanted to go and use it. So in actual fact, we believe that significant ice is easily accessible, but we won't really know until we get down on the surface and rove into some of these areas to find out.
All right, so how, nobody really knows how deep you'd have to drill or dig or something just to reach it?
Well, this stuff is near the surface. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things is that the sensing techniques that we use, which is basically sensing neutrons and their interaction with the moon, and then also radar, which sends out radio pulses, which are then reflected from the moon, those are all sampling very shallow depths. The neutron sensing goes down to about a meter. The radar goes down to a couple of meters. So this ice that's there that we're seeing is actually within the uppermost surface of the moon. And when you think about it, that makes sense because the stuff has been added within the last few billion years. So that's the uppermost part of the lunar surface. And so you don't really have to drill. You don't have to sink deep shafts and adits like terrestrial mines. You can pretty much scoop it up from the surface and then heat it directly to extract the water.
We can take some questions here now for Paul Spoutis, who's the author of Value of the Moon, about the uses of the moon, both for our purposes and for space exploration as well. Here's Scott in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, is that me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi. You know, sometimes you see a space movie where the people have this unbelievable high-tech technology like a spacecraft, and then they always throw in something that's hopelessly and inexplicably anachronistic, like they're fighting each other with swords or something. You know what I mean? In the last movie, we saw Matt Damon, and he's like trying to feed himself, and he's planting potatoes, and he's got to wait like months to eat. And so my comment was about your guest's suggestion of how to grow food in outer space, plants. And my suggestion is that plants, having to grow plants would be, in the same vein, hopelessly anachronistic. I mean, you have to wait so long to be able to grow a plant. You have to throw all sorts of resources and water, and they have to grow in just the right medium. And I'd say, well, if we're going to be serious about actually going into space, we need to find a way to feed ourselves that does not involve growing plants. You need to be able to extract, we kind of know what we need in a vague way, but we need to be able to extract it from whatever is on that planet and be able to process that somehow into food without going into plants or animals.
Okay, let's see what Paul has to say about that. Thanks for that, Scott.
Well, that's an interesting observation, and in principle, you're right. I mean, if you have a set of elements that make up food and you know how those elements are configured with respect to each other, theoretically, you could synthesize whatever food you wanted to eat. So I would just take a half a pound of calcium and a quarter, 50 pounds of carbon and 200 pounds of water and mix them all up in a bowl, and voila, I get a giant turkey dinner for 20 people.
Blah.
The problem with that is that although we know how these elements are configured and we know what the chemical composition of food is, it takes a lot of energy and time to rearrange those atoms and molecules into the form that not only are palatable, but that won't kill us. So synthesizing food is a very extremely energy-intensive process. The reason people talk about growing plants in space and doing very simple chemical processing, such as melting water ice from ice-laden regolith on the moon, the reason that's done is because we are energy-limited. We don't have unlimited energy. We don't have antimatter reactors, and we don't have big nukes that can generate thousands of megawatts of power. We're dependent on energy that we can gather with sunlight, on solar arrays that might generate only a few tens of kilowatts. So at that level of energy consumption. And at that level of energy availability, it makes sense to use the lowest tech processes we can imagine. And, you know, agriculture has existed for 5,000 years, and most of the industrial processing we want to do with the water at the poles dates from the 18th century. So, yes, it's retro in a technological sense. You're absolutely correct. But the reason it's retro is because we just don't have unlimited energy and time. We need to do things that, A, we know how to do, and, B, that we are capable of doing with limited time and energy on the moon.
The book is called The Value of the Moon, How to Explore, Live, and Prosper in Space Using the Moon's Resources. Paul Spoudis wrote it. He's a geologist and a lunar scientist, and we'll come back and talk more with Paul and take some phone calls and emails from you as you learn to explore the moon just a little more, both from the Earth remotely via robotic craft and perhaps once again by actually sending people to the moon. We'll hear more about that and talk more about the moon's history and potential future use when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Spoudis and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. What was once considered impossibly futuristic is now actually 44 years behind us. That's how long it's been since people walked on the moon. Today's guest takes an issue with that. He is a geologist and lunar scientist, Paul Spoudis. He's written a book called The Value of the Moon, How to Explore, Live, and Prosper in Space Using the Moon's Resources. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments about space exploration, the moon in particular, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jean in Winston. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, hello. Well, I have a question, but first I'd like to make a couple of comments. Paul, thank you so much for your contribution to exploration of our solar system. And about the food thing, maybe some kind of algae cultivation would be easy. And then I wondered about what do you think about the effect on human consciousness of living in free fall?
In weightless conditions, yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for that, Gene. Appreciate it. Paul?
Yeah, I think we can't really predict it. It's likely to have profound implications culturally to having people live on another world. And by the way, on the moon, you're not really in free fall. The moon has its own gravity well. It's a planet. It has a significant amount of mass. It's much lower than the Earth. You'll feel very buoyant. And at 1/6 gravity, you kind of easily stride around with very low impact on your joints. So it ought to be good for old people. It's like myself to get around on the moon because of the low gravity. But I think the fact of living on another world where you see the Earth hanging over the horizon and you're able to imagine that everything that you've known or ever loved lives on that body, I think it's going to have very profound effects on people. It will change our perspective. It'll change our appreciation of the Earth, and I think it will probably make us better stewards of the planet by living there.
You know, we were talking recently with a different author about what it's like to live in space and talking about weightlessness and its effect on people. I'm curious, though, about the moon itself. You just mentioned, obviously, you do have some mass there, but a sixth of what you have on the Earth. Would you potentially see the same sort of muscle? It's not necessarily an atrophy, but at least a loss of muscle mass or something from living in a place with so little gravity?
It's possible, but that brings up a very good point. One of the things we want to learn from a return to the moon is what is the effect of fractional gravity on the human body. We know that living in microgravity, living in the free fall of the of Earth orbit, as on the space station, that has some negative effects on human physiology. You lose muscle mass, you lose bone mass. It has some apparently negative effects on the shape of the eyeball. So there are possibly long-term vision problems with extended microgravity. But we don't know that for the moon. The longest stay on the moon by any human was about 3 days, and that was on Apollo 17, the last mission. They stayed a little bit over 3 days, and they didn't experience any negative effects from that length of time, but that's not long enough to really let you know whether there are negative effects to human physiology and the workings of our body. And so that's one of the things we want to answer. It's important not only for the long-term habitation of the moon, but ultimately when we go to the planets. For example, if we go to Mars, Mars has about one-third the gravity, a little more than one-third the gravity of the Earth. So that's more than the moon, but it's still a significant amount of significantly lower gravity there than on the Earth. So understanding the effects of human response to fractional gravity is one of the important science things we want to do when we go back.
Another Jeffrey via email writes, why doesn't the moon rotate about its axis like the Earth? Is this typical for all moons, the way the moon keeps the one face to us at all times?
Well, it does rotate on its axis. What the problem is that the moon also orbits the Earth. And because of that, the time it takes to make one revolution around the Earth is exactly the same as the time it takes to rotate once on its axis. So as a result, we only see one side of the moon at all times. Now, it wobbles a little bit. Sometimes we see a little bit over the eastern and western limbs, and because the plane of the orbit is inclined to the Earth, we see sometimes beyond and both poles. We see about 56% of the moon's surface in total. But because of that synchronous rotation, which, by the way, we think was established very early in Earth-Moon history, we always see the same side. So the moon does rotate. It rotates on its axis every 708 hours.
The rotation and revolution as essentially the same period, is that something fairly consistent in space, or is it just as different as the planets and objects that revolve around each other that are going to have that relationship?
It's actually quite common among satellites and primaries. So, for example, on Jupiter, the Galilean satellites, the big satellites, are in synchronous rotation, as with some of the satellites of Saturn. The smaller satellites, the things that are like captured asteroids, small irregular rocks, tend to have more chaotic distributions of orbital and revolution and rotation periods.
Like the Martian moons, which are like potatoes in space?
Exactly. Although I believe Phobos is in synchronous rotation.
Okay.
One of the interesting things is if they're elongated in any sense, and Phobos, one of the moons of Mars, is elongated, those objects will tend to align themselves radial to the gravity field. So we've seen this on Earth. We've actually done an experiment where cigar-shaped objects tend to align themselves with the long axis pointing toward the center of the Earth.
Huh, that's really interesting. Another question here by phone. Here's Bob in Jacksonville. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Spoutis, the author of The Value of the Moon.
Yes, one of the questions has been addressed.
Go ahead.
Oh, one of the questions has been covered, the effects of no gravity or less gravity on our bodies. And really, I guess what I'm questioning is the billions of dollars spent, and it strikes me as an ego trip, and it must be lovely to see the Earth out there, but between the other facts, we will never travel faster than the speed of light. We don't live long enough to cover these vast distances. And if we did, colonize Mars, how crazy is that? The costs of feeding ourselves and everything else, where are the gains to justify these billions of dollars of expenditure?
All right, not the first person to ask that, and thanks for that, Bob. Appreciate it. Paul?
Okay, that's a fair question, and I get this a lot. You know, what's the value of going back to the moon if all we're going to do is exist there, or at least struggle to survive? I think what you have to consider is that modern civilization is critically dependent on a variety of satellite assets that are in Earth orbit. And they're not simply in low Earth orbit. They're in the zone of space that I call cislunar space. That's the area of space between the Earth and the moon, and it includes the moon as well. And we depend on these satellites for a lot of critical functions. We use them for weather prediction. We use them for global communications. The GPS constellation is in Middle Earth orbit. That's at about 1,000 kilometers. We use them for national security. We use them to monitor other nations and what their intentions are and what they're sending into space. All of these things are absolutely critical to modern life. And at the moment, these satellites are operated on a paradigm of custom design, build, launch, and abandon. And if we had a system that allowed us to routinely access that zone of space, we would be able to build systems of much greater capacity and capability than we now have, and to protect and maintain the existing assets there as well. So one of the argument I make in the book, and the reason I think going back to the moon is important, is that it will allow us to establish a transportation system in cislunar space. That's this zone where all of the pay zone, where all of our satellite assets are, to service, maintain, upgrade, and build new extended distributed systems of enormous power. So to give you one example of what that might entail, you could build a communication satellite at geosynchronous orbit. That's 36,000 kilometers above the Earth, in which the time it takes to rotate the Earth is equal to the rotation rate of the Earth. So the satellite appears to hover at one point in the sky. And with that kind of satellite, you would also be able to, in one fell swoop, you would have complete hemispheric communication coverage. You would make all the entire terrestrial cell phone network obsolete in an instant. And that kind of satellite is too big to launch from the Earth on a rocket. You couldn't fit it on a rocket. But you could build it in space if you were able to routinely go back and forth to it. And that's what the value of the lunar water is. You could make rocket propellant that enables you to go and visit all these different access zones of cislunar space where these satellite assets reside. Now, that's a practical value. It serves critical national, economic, scientific, and security needs, and at the same time allows us to build systems that will enable us ultimately to go to the planets. I agree with them. It's not likely we're going to colonize Mars for several hundred years, but that doesn't mean that there aren't compelling reasons to go there and other places where we have important things to do and important questions to answer.
In the scenario you envision, though, how much stuff would you have to take to the moon? I mean, how many trips worth of stuff potentially just to be able to begin to use the moon as a resource, to be able to extract things from it that you could then make trips not all the way back to the Earth?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things I present in the book, and it's the result of some work that I've done in the last few years, is to look at how you could begin using what the moon has to offer, first with teleoperated robots. You would send machines, because the moon's close, it's only 3 seconds round-trip light time, you could send rovers and remote-controlled robots to the moon to begin mining water that's there and storing it. And all that kind of activity could be controlled by operators that are here on Earth. Ultimately, these things would need to be serviced and adjusted and modified by people, but people don't have to go immediately. You could actually begin doing this within the next few years, and within a decade or so, you would have a working system of mining robots on the moon actually creating the kind of fuel depots I've been talking about. And we did some cost estimates on this, and that kind of level of effort would fit under the existing NASA budget. The existing NASA budget is about $20 billion per year. And by the way, that is less than one-half of 1% of the total federal budget.
So just out of curiosity at this point, when we talk about taking water out of the moon, knowing what you do about the minerals that are present there, how might moon water taste? And how much treatment would it require?
It'll probably have to be processed, because the water that's at the poles probably comes from a cometary source. You know, comets hit the moon all the time. They bombard the moon. There's no atmosphere to stop them. That water, a lot of it's lost to space during the impact process, but some of it that's retained is going to be kept in these cold traps near the poles. Now, it's not just water. They have other substances, some of them quite nasty. There are things like methane. There are things like ammonia. There are a variety of hydrocarbons, simple hydrocarbons, in cometary ice. So what you would do is, when you first extract the water from the polar ice, you would have to distill it to make sure that it's pure enough to use for human use, and also for things like rocket propellant. But that's fairly simple to do. That's easily That's another low-tech thing. Fractional distillation is something that we've done for hundreds of years, and that's what we'd probably have to do to the water that we harvest from the moon.
So you go through the history of thoughts about going to the moon and Mars over the course of the last 20, 25 years or so. Has the dollars been the thing that has generally stopped us, the cost of equipping a mission to go out in space again?
In part. Partly it's the money, but also it's the fact that we haven't really been imaginative enough. The idea of using what the moon has to offer to enable this is actually, believe it or not, fairly new. The reason it's new is because we didn't know until recently that the moon had these resources. So because of the missions that have flown since about 2009, I guess was when the first one was launched, there have been missions by India, by the United States, by European Space Agency, and by China. And they've all mapped the moon to varying degrees with various parameters. And it's only this new knowledge in the last few years that have told us that these resources are present on the moon and they are available to use. So that idea is taking time to sink into the consciousness of people that plan long-term missions for NASA. And the idea of using resources from another world is kind of a new idea, too. So it's going to take some time for this to for people to be comfortable with this idea.
We tend to focus on this as a governmental effort. And in the half minute we have left, Paul, I mean, what do you see about the possibility of further private involvement in space exploration all the way out to the moon?
Well, that's already begun. There are many companies that are interested in developing space and, in fact, going back to the moon. Companies that are trying to develop small, inexpensive robotic systems that deliver payloads to the moon for a variety of purposes. So that may well happen, and I think it's something that should be encouraged.
All right. We have learned a lot today. There's much to be found in the book. It's called The Value of the Moon, How to Explore, Live, and Prosper in Space Using the Moon's Resources. Paul Spudis wrote it and joined us today in exchange. Paul, thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.